The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
And I apologize for that. You're trying to clear everybody out of here. But we are going to start talking a little bit about this session today is about health equity in the South Asian community. My name is Sapna Pandya, and I actually direct the programs for an organization in New York called the South Asian Health Initiative. South Asian Health Initiative, or SAHI, is actually part of NYU, and Kritika here as well. Same beast over in New York City of an academic institution. We can talk a little bit about the challenges of working within the community, within the academy. Also, the other thing that I'm involved in are a few of the projects. I'm also involved in a collective called the Humsafra International, which is basically a collective of trainers that train on sexual health issues, dealing with lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, South Asians, and we basically are doing cultural competence trainings. And I'm also involved with another initiative called the Gina Circle, which is basically a philanthropy project. It's a foundation that we're starting to raise money for all the various causes and the needs that you're about to hear about, all the various health needs as well as other needs. So I want to start a little bit before I kind of go on and introduce everyone by first introducing the topic. The topic of health equity. Obviously, you all are here because you have some interest or some inkling about what these words really mean to you. And I'm curious also during the Q&A about why you were here, why you came to this session. But the word equity, if I can take that and sort of just to frame, hopefully, the way that we will discuss also health equity and the way that we have discussed health. To me, and I think to all of us, equity is really, you know, a sense of fairness and a sense of justice. And that's sort of the approach that we're taking in terms of talking about the health disparities in the South Asian community. It's coming from a social justice framework. And when I say that, I feel I mean also a proper distribution of resources so that, you know, we just heard in the last session that about 0.3% of all funding dollars go to Asian Pacific Islander communities in the country. 0.3%. That's an abysmally low rate, obviously. That is unfair distribution of resources, obviously. We also know that in the United States that only 1.5% of medical costs are spent on the undocumented. 1.5%. Okay? Think about everything that you've heard in the media about how the undocumented are draining our Medicaid dollars and taking up our emergency rooms. It's 1.5% of all medical costs. And, of course, of the undocumented, one of the fastest growing undocumented populations are some of the South Asian populations. So, you know, we do comprise part of that 1.5%. What else do I mean by distribution of resources? I also mean things like how much is budgeted for South Asian populations in a hospital or in a healthcare setting? How much is budgeted for South Asian personnel? How many times do you sort of come across a situation where you have a patient in a hospital and instead of getting a trained, qualified interpreter, they pull a family member, they pull a staff member, or they pull somebody else to come interpret? It's almost as if our community is maybe not worth enough to actually have a trained, qualified interpreter there in the hospital to address the needs of all of our South Asian patients, that they're just kind of going by the wayside and pulling somebody else to come interpret. So I want to touch on a few different sort of ways in which, of course, we have maybe unfair distribution of resources addressing the South Asian community and contributing to some of the health disparities that we see. And so we are going to talk a little bit about some of the health disparities as well. I have with me here three very accomplished people working and have been working in the health field, and I think, if I may speak for them, have come to working in public health from various avenues and paths as well. We all didn't necessarily start out as, you know, medicine or health being our interest, per se, but that's where we have ended up, and we've come from different places, and I'd like to talk about that. Sitting right next to me is Kritika Ghosh. Kritika, works. Thank you. Kritika I met actually doing work that was not maybe strictly public health work, doing work on domestic violence in New York City. She works right now three floors down from me at New York University as well at the Center for the Study of Asian American Health. Kritika is a coordinator of a project called the DREAM Project. The DREAM Project, and we have some people here as well from the DREAM Project, addresses diabetes in the Bangladeshi community in New York City. So that's Kritika sitting next to me here. Next to her is Diana Jang. Diana is the policy director at the Asian Pacific Islands Health Forum, something we just call the Health Forum usually, because it is that sort of well-known in the community. It's a national advocacy organization, and the Health Forum is dedicated to promoting the health and the well-being of the overall API community, including the South Asian community. And next to her, we have Rajinder Kaur. And Rajinder is the Associate Coordinator of Community Health Action Initiative, or CHAI. We all just come up with these kind of fun little acronyms. It has to mean something in some South Asian language somewhere. So CHAI, Community Health Action Initiative, is at the South Asian Network, or SAN, which is in Los Angeles in Southern California. So we're going to have a few questions with them. I do want to just say one more thing with regards to how we're thinking about health equity. And this is something that I learned when I was in public health school. This is one of the, maybe, I'm sorry to say, but one of the maybe the few really useful things that I found myself repeating over the last 10 years, which is, since I graduated or whatever, which is looking at accessibility, affordability, and adequacy. Basically, in order to really be equitable, to really have good healthcare for our South Asian community, we need to look at these three things. Is the healthcare affordable? Is it accessible? And is it adequate? Are we really meeting the health needs of our population? And so, you know, with that, I'm going to kind of turn it over here and talk a little bit about this idea of health equity and ask that, you know, if we were to reach this goal, this sort of dream that we're all thinking of about health equity, what would the South Asian community look like? What does that mean to you? And I, you know, I'm just going to go down the line here. Maybe Kritika, if you want to respond to that to begin with.
Sure. I think you've done a good job also in framing the, you know, the term health equity. But first of all, thank you all for coming to the health panel. And obviously, health is an issue that's, you know, important to the community. It cuts across all of these boundaries that we are going to be talking about today in terms of class, gender, identity, immigration, you know, but all of these factors play a major role in health equity as well. In the terms of the South Asian community, health equity is looking at, and this is a term that I think 10 people used this morning, and I almost want to cut it out and put something different, but holistic, or I guess a comprehensive approach to health, looking at disease prevention and access to health care, amongst other issues, because health is not just about disease. It's not just about diabetes or cardiovascular disease or breast cancer. It's about, you know, not just how we how do we contact those diseases, but how do we actually, how is the community facing the structure of the community, how there are barriers to get access to care, how there are, as Sapna mentioned, you know, in terms of translation, health equity would mean that there is adequate health information about the various diseases and that its causes would be available to health community members in their language and in culturally specific terms. It also means going beyond just information. We need to go to increase access to healthy and affordable food, culturally appropriate healthcare, and provide community centers where people can engage in physical activities, support groups, and training groups. Because it shouldn't just be, something I mentioned, I'm not coming from a health background. I'm coming more from an organizing and advocacy background. So for me and the work that I do, it's really important to empower community members to be in charge of their own health and to understand the root causes of what the barriers are to healthcare. So I think creating spaces where people can discuss that healthcare is not just a physical attribute, it's connected to emotional health. And those are issues that we don't really talk about much in our community. I know that there are people here who do work around, therapy and other issues, and this is emotional and mental health is something that we completely try to, like, you know, nobody wants to talk about it in our communities. It's important, we have a lot of people in our communities who want to become doctors. We have MD students and things like that. That's great, but we also need, in order to, service the community, we need to train and recruit more South Asians into healthcare as nurses, translators, and other providers, and also train existing healthcare providers to be culturally sensitive and to have the tools to work with the South Asian community. Health equity is also about equitable representation. As Sapna mentioned, mentioned, you know, in terms of, you mentioned a statistic in terms of how many percentage of, undocumented immigrants get healthcare, but we also need to have documentation of our work and our community, and that's something that SALT does really well, so that we can understand our healthcare needs. And it's also important to look at healthcare not just as a healthcare issue, but as intersection to issues like immigration, language access, and gender equity as well, because it's not just about health, it's about we all have multiple intersections in our lives, so that's really important. And if health equity was to be reached, I envision a South Asian community that's not just physically and emotionally healthy, but also creates spaces for the community members themselves to be empowered enough to discuss their needs. So it's not just us on the panel, but community members, who I'm so glad are here.
Right. That's great. Yeah, I mean, in terms of the immigration thing, I mean, you know, going back to the equity question, you know, I just want to share one story with you that might also reflect the immigration issue and how important that is, how crucial that is to the question. I could, of course, take the case of we have very obvious examples of somebody who's undocumented and therefore does not have access to health care. But, you know, let's even take, we had a health fair once in Jackson Heights. It was going on all day, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. We're just about to wrap up. It was about 3 o'clock. Pretty much everyone, the crowd was thinning out. It had been huge all day, tens of thousands of people. This one guy comes up who completely seemed like somebody who would be a friend of mine. You know, I mean, he's my age. You know, we just started chatting. He's like, hey, what are you guys doing here? You know, so I completely, my whole defenses came down. I just started chatting with him very casually. I've been checking thousands of people's blood pressure and blood sugar all day long. I thought I'd take a break. And then I said, you know, we're checking blood pressure. So just for kicks, I decided to check his blood pressure as well. Turned out to be 220 over 180, which, as many of you may know, is incredibly high. I figured that must be a joke. The machine is probably tired from having checked so many BPs all day. I checked it again. I called a doctor over with the steth, and his cough, and we checked it again. It was high all three times. That's when suddenly I was like, oh my God, wait a second. This is something's going on. He was a 32-year-old Indian immigrant on an H-1 visa, on a worker visa. You know, working here from an affluent, you know, sector of Bombay society. You know, he's working in New York. He has a job. He speaks English, and you know, so those things, in those ways, he's very privileged. His BP's through the roof. I sent him to the hospital, and the only hospital he could go to was the local government hospital, because despite these things of speaking English and being from an affluent class back home and having a job, he didn't have health insurance. And so I sent him to the government hospital. He got checked. He was discharged at 4 o'clock in the morning. And 3 months later, he was showing signs of a stroke. And I asked him why he didn't go back for his follow-up appointment. But what he said to me was, he got a bill, he got a bill from the hospital for $10,000. Okay, this is obviously not a sum to be laughed at, $10,000. And that, it wasn't just the money that scared him. The thing that really scared him was the fact that if he went back again, they would have documentation of the fact that he had now also paid the bill. And he was very afraid, being on a work visa, how that would impact his getting a green card. So for that reason alone, he did not end up going back to the hospital, almost seriously causing him his life. I mean, when I talked to him 3 months later, he was literally telling me that, oh, this morning I was showering, my left eye was drooping, and I was getting a little dizzy. I'm sure it's fine. I'll eat something and I'll be okay. I'm like, no, you need to go to the hospital right now. And this is why he was scared. So this is just a hint to highlight. You know, when we talk about immigration, of course we're talking about things like legalization and all of that, but there's so many others that fall through the cracks and that we think maybe are just totally fine. Somebody like him would not have been on my radar with the health fair. But, you know, we do need to also think about looking at access to health care for really everybody. So, you know, with that, I want to kind of turn it over also to you with regards to the policy piece and how policy relates to health equity. And how would policy create that picture of health equity that you would like to see?
Okay. Thank you, Saka. Great to have. I really don't have to say anything after those great examples in your overview. Just as very observant of you that we all come from the health equity from different angles. I actually have a legal background, and I know the conference is co-sponsored by SALSA. How many of you are in law school or are attorneys? There's nothing to be ashamed of. I've been in the legal world for a while and focused on social justice issues, immigration, and language access. And I came to the House Forum in the mid-90s after Congress passed the First Source Possibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act, so-called welfare reform law that cut off, you know, benefits to immigrants. So that's why I came to the House Forum to try to repeal that law and make it better in California. But I think it's great that you started out with that definition of equity, because I think a lot of people don't understand what equity means. And as an attorney and coming from a civil rights perspective, I grew up in the 60s, and it's been 45 years since the Civil Rights Act of 1964 passed. So all the legal barriers, all the discrimination is against the law. But yet here, 45 years later, you still have inequality and disparities in terms of opportunity, health, you know, even though there's been fair housing laws on the books for decades, our country is more segregated than it was even in the 60s. And in the health area, it's not an exception either. Even though we're the wealthiest country in the world and we spend the most money on healthcare, we spend $2 trillion a year on healthcare. And yet, our health status is not improving, and especially for racial and ethnic minorities. I think the Health Forum started over 20 years ago, and the impetus for the Health Forum organizing is in 1985, the Secretary of Health and Human Services at that time, Margaret Heckler, published a groundbreaking report on the number of excess deaths experienced by blacks and other minorities. Well, guess what? One sentence the report said, Asian Americans as a whole are healthier than any other racial group in the United States. So, many people in our community, activists, community-minded physicians, and other community organizers, were very, very, as you can guess, very concerned about this, that the health needs of our communities would not be addressed. And so they formed the Asian American Health Forum to try to work towards improving data and research in our communities. I think in terms of resources, as Safa said, because of our good health status, very few research studies are done on our health and health needs. There's very little data, especially disaggregated data, about our communities. And if you do disaggregate the data, you can see a lot of disparities within specific groups. So, for example, cancer is the leading cause of death for Asian Americans as a group. But if you look at specific groups, say the Vietnamese community, Vietnamese men are 13 times more likely to have liver cancer than white men. And Vietnamese women are 6 times more likely to have cervical cancer. So because we have that information, we've been able to get resources dedicated to address those specific health issues. And the same is true of the South Asian communities. So you, unlike other Asian American groups, heart disease is a huge issue for you. And Asian Indian men have been found to have a rate of heart attacks that's 3 times higher of the general U.S. population. So we need that data and research in order to get the equitable distribution of resources that our groups need. So that's sort of the difference between equality and equity. And so on a policy level, we have some opportunities now to address some of these equity issues within the healthcare reform work. And just so you know, in healthcare, our healthcare system, not only are we spending a lot of money, but it's not, one of the reasons we are is that it's not a healthcare system. It's a sick care system. So what I like about using the public health framework and the social justice framework is that we're not going to be healthier by getting more healthcare. We really need to look at what they call public health terminology, the social determinants of health. So looking at, I like how they look at an all-sided look at your environment. It's not just your individual behaviors, because in the last administration, their focus on getting people healthier was to say, you need to eat better and exercise more. Well, what prevents you from doing that? I mean, I know, yes, I'm pretty bad at, I think I eat pretty well, but in terms of exercising, working 12 hours a day doesn't really a good environment for me to exercise. But when you think about people who live in poverty, if you think about low-income neighborhoods where people live and they don't have access to grocery stores, they only have access to a corner liquor store that has very expensive food, and most of it is not good food, it's not fresh produce. And when you think about the safety of your neighborhood and, you know, the lack of parks for children to play in that are safe, women who don't feel safe walking at home at night or doing things at night, a lot of where you live really impacts your ability to be healthy. So
yeah, I'm just going to cut you off.
Yeah.
I'm going to come back to you in a second. I'm just mindful of time. And I'm glad that you mentioned some of the disparities, because I do want to definitely move into talking a little bit about the disparities. We do have some data that's out there. I think part of the thing that Deanna is encouraging and that we've all encouraged is that any numbers that we have out there, we need to share with others. I think we're all doing great work, and everyone keeps on saying, we've been saying for years and years, there's a paucity of data. I don't know how many times you've heard the phrase, you know, there's a paucity of data on the South Asian community. Yes, there is, but that does not mean there's a paucity of work happening in the South Asian community. We just, and it doesn't mean that we need to publish in medical journals necessarily all the time either. We can publish wherever, but the point is to share what we're doing. You know, just a few more numbers going on to that, because you mentioned looking in your neighborhood. I encourage all of you also to take a little walk around the South Asian neighborhoods in your area. You know, I did so, and you, of course, attest to this, that in Jackson Heights, in the grocery stores, you don't find very many skim milk options, right? There are many, many gallons of whole milk products, and very few of skim milk. Now, that, of course, reflects our dietary habits and our dietary preferences, but unfortunately, it's bad for heart health. That's probably why we have 3 times the number of Asian Indian men getting heart attacks, and 4 times the number of South Asians that have diabetes as compared to the rest of the community is part of that. We have rows and rows of ghee, and we have one small little section of olive oil on the side.
Right.
And the price, if you compare, is a big difference. It's much cheaper to buy a lot of ghee than to buy one thing of olive oil, right? So we do, I mean, have to definitely address these things. To me, grocery stores are a good reflection of how the community is eating. And so, you know, it's an interesting kind of study to look at that. Just a few more stats, and that's where I'm going to go to Rajendra as well to talk about how we acknowledge these disparities and how we address them in the work that we're doing. You know, we talked about the income level. You know, just to sort of, maybe all of you have already busted the model minority myth, but, you know, of course, we have 2/3 of Bangladeshi seniors live in poverty. And that's a startling number if you think about it. And on the first hand, we're talking about elderly populations who already are disadvantaged, and then 2/3 of them living in poverty. The per capita income. Okay, the per capita income, contrary to what we believe in the South Asian community, on average for Bangladeshi is about $13,500 a year. One person, $13,500 a year. That, if you look at the price of healthcare, is nothing. Because you cannot afford good, adequate healthcare with $13,500, because you're too busy paying your rent, taking care of your kids, taking care of your legal expenses, your immigration expenses, to worry about actually being able to pay for health insurance. And that only goes up a little bit in other communities, $17,000 to $24,000 for the Pakistani Indian communities. And I can go on with more numbers, but if the top end is $24,000 per capita income on average, that's not very high. As I don't have to tell you that, obviously, $24,000 to live on a year is not very high. And that's, these are, you know, low numbers that we're looking at, which busts the moral minority myth that we have out there about all the you know, sort of wealthy South Asians, which there are some, but we have, you know, two ends of the spectrum, of course. You know, in terms of literacy and education as well, we're also looking at where are people educated and how are they educated and what access do they have in their home country. And so, you know, I do want to now, you know, kind of go over to the issue of language as well and how that plays a part in maybe some of the communities that you've worked with. If we're looking at half of South Asian households being limited English proficient or being linguistically isolated, I don't know how many of you have heard that term, where nobody in the house speaks English at all. We're looking at about 1/3 of some South Asian communities where nobody in the house speaks English at all. That's huge. With that, Rajendra, I send it over to you to kind of talk a little bit about how are you addressing those disparities at SAN and in Southern California?
Well, it's a huge problem. Most of our communities don't speak English. Their children are the ones that serve as translators for their languages. And they're young children that sort of don't have the terminology to explain to their mom or their dad, to see the doctor's name. Sometimes it's a very sensitive issue, like the health concerns, and they don't know how to tell the news to their parents. So There's some of the county hospitals have translation services through a phone from AT&T, which I haven't heard any good feedback from. So a lot of times we usually go with our community members to county hospitals or have them make sure, like the day before, a couple days before, that they've got a qualified interpreter to go with them to the county hospital. But going back to health equity, I wanted to talk in equality. It's got to be culturally, linguistically appropriate healthcare for all communities, so that the healthcare practitioners really understand the needs of each community and address those issues. Health material needs to be in a language, and even though it's in a language, a lot of our communities don't read and write their own language, so it's needs to actually explain to them, well, this is what the material is saying, this is the way we take care of your health. And I also see a lot of, and in terms of health equity outcomes, there's different outcomes for different communities. Right now, the South Asian community they don't have regular access to healthcare, so if they wanted to quit tobacco or take care of their health, they don't have the resources that don't go once, like you said, but then they won't follow up again. And then also healthy communities right now in affluent areas, there's more access to healthier food, recreation areas, and parks, but in low-income art communities, there's tons of fast food, every single corner, there's tons of liquor stores, and it's forced on the price, tons and tons of advertisement, and then there's fewer parks, so health equity would also mean healthier communities that we're all part of. And I think the South Asian community, in my work, I've seen that females don't really have a lot of power of their health. When we talk to them about their health, they'll don't wait. It's like, let me wait till my husband gets home, and then I'll let you know if I should go in for that screening. So I think in terms of health equity, our females in our community would have more power over their health. They especially, and it's really important to educate the females in our community, because they sort of have power over the food and then what their family members eat. So if you educate them on nutrition and their diet, they're able to sort of spread that information. And then our acronym JAI sort of came about that we're notorious for having tea 5 times a day, but afternoon tea, as long as we sit around and we talk, and we might gossip at times, but then we sort of want to talk about health. So hopefully we're encouraging people to get around lunch and be able to have afternoons, talk about the health issues and that.
Thank you. You know, in terms of the culturally appropriate thing, I also want to mention, I mean, there are people out there doing cultural competence trainings, and I think we all have to kind of do our bit in whatever way, whether it's a sort of standardized training or whether it's just however it is that we can pass that information on to providers about what our community needs. It's important for us all to kind of do that little step as well, especially because, unfortunately, you may all have seen, there are cultural competence guides that sort of, I don't like saying this word, but mainstream sort of groups, you know, use about our communities, which are very funny if you pick them up. There's one that I saw, culturally competent care, and they had a chapter on every community in the United States. I'm not kidding you. It was like a 2-3 page like cheat sheet on how to work with Mexicans, how to work with Chinese people, oh my God. And the page on how about culturally appropriate care for they specifically said the Asian Indian population of the South Asian community, and looked at the Asian Indian population. Culturally appropriate care for working with an Asian Indian woman, going back to the woman thing. Do not make eye contact with her, because Indian women do not like to look at you in the eyes. They prefer to look down on the floor, and they are modest. It would be recommended that if you have an Indian patient, that you, Indian female patient, that you speak to her male head of household. I'm not kidding you. This is a cultural competence guide that I saw in New York City. Imagine, I don't have to tell you, if the provider is only talking to their Indian female patient's husband or boyfriend or other male partner that she has, what is going on in terms of addressing her health needs, right? So my point is also to kind of give us a wake-up call about, you know, looking out there for what is being taught about our communities to folks. These are being distributed at medical schools and at hospitals. And so, you know, we need to combat that with our own information about the community as well. And, so I want to switch gears here a little bit and talk about, all these dismal facts and all. Talk about what good is being done as well. And we have several different models of sort of approaching the South Asian community. Whether it's healthcare, like I mentioned, or another model, there's a really exciting, there's been a really sort of shift of empowerment to community members themselves to take charge of your health. I'm taking a phrase from what Prithika said about empowering people to take charge of their own health. And that you may have heard in other communities has also been used, the community health worker model. I want to talk a little bit, Prithika, about the Dream Project, because I think it's been very revolutionary in terms of taking this community health worker model and addressing, approaching the South Asian community with it. I wanted to ask you about some of the challenges in using the community health worker model, and then Rajinder, the approaches, the initiatives that Chai has used as well in terms of reaching to the community. So, you know, you both, if you could sort of take a couple minutes and respond to them.
Okay. How many of you are familiar with a community health worker model? Okay. Well, I'm just preaching to them. So a community health worker model builds off, you know, of organizing, community organizing traditions, and it looks at community members as being the source of information of their own health instead of, like I was saying earlier, I go there and be like, oh, this is what you need to do, blah, 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 blah. Like, you know, that's what I think in every other aspect of the work that we do in our communities, that's how it is. The service provision model, which the community health worker model is breaking down. It looks at building, you know, power of the community from the community itself. And it's basically a community health worker model looks at, in our case, we have hired community members who are coming to us with a wealth of knowledge and from their community organizing backgrounds about the community, its resources, its challenges, and they're going through an intensive training about the health aspect of things. And I just wanted to recognize Mom Noon, who's one of our Dream Community Health Workers. And this model basically looks at, you know, training these health workers on research, on the health, you know, like about diabetes and all of that. But they themselves are coming with the knowledge of these where the community members live. These are the organizations in the community. This is how we can access them. So the actual outreach and organizing and the knowledge comes from them. And we're just adding on information that's about health issues itself. You know, so the Green Community Health Workers, Mamnoon is from the Taxi Workers Alliance, which is one of the, you know, major labor organizing agencies in New York City. And our other community health worker, Nahar Alam, she couldn't be here today. She is one of the founders, she's the founder of Andolan, which is also a workers' rights organization. And we thought it was really important. We didn't decide to choose just people working in workers' rights, but in our community, which is working in the Bangladeshi community, which is, as Sapna mentioned, it's a very new immigrant community. It has increased over 400% in the past 10 years in population. And I don't go by census numbers because I think they're woefully underestimated, so I'm not even going to quote them, but the community has grown by leaps and bounds. And also diabetes is a major concern in the community. And we have been doing need assessment surveys in the community, which show a 28% rate of diabetes in the Bangladeshi community, well, compared to 7% in the general Asian American community in New York City. So it's obviously an issue in our communities. We also have a coalition which we follow this framework of community-based participatory research, in which we have academic partners and community agency partners meet and give us guidance on how to do our work. And then we had our first meet, we went around and introduced ourselves, and all the ladies, no matter where they were from, they're like, oh, I'm so-and-so, and yeah, my mother has diabetes, or I have diabetes, you know, so it was just like a rite of passage, sadly enough, in our communities. But the communities have been thinking of you. Oh, yeah. You know, in terms of what we are finding, we've been community health worker model. You know, we have been using that they will be, our health workers are going to be providing group session trainings to diabetic Bangladeshis in New York City, and we think this is the most effective way to use this model because. You know, we recently did a series of 6 focus groups in the community in New York City, which is one of the first focus groups on diabetes in the Bangladeshi community. I don't think if we had just hired any random health professional or whatever, they would have been able to pull out, so bring such a variety of people and bring them together and have these discussions in the framework that we use. And, you know, we will be disseminating the information soon about what we learned from the focus group. So some of what you guys are saying in terms of language access, things like that. And just to add to something, I wanted to add to this whole language access thing is that our CHW, you know, highlights to say, oh, I like to I had to just translate from Bengali to Bengali. Because you will say that this material is so unreadable that you need a PhD in Bangla to read it, you know, and I think what most people do is hire professionals to translate in just a terminology that doesn't work for us. So one of the things that we at the CHW project have been doing is to write out create materials that are accessible to community and communicate in a manner that is accessible as well, which is really important, you know, and that's what our CHWs do really well. And they are also going to be training other community members to further the work. So it's not just, oh, now we have hired two people from the community. We want this to become a model that's replicated in the community so that we can take charge of our own health.
Other example, how many of you here speak Hindi? Okay. How many of you understand the term Asurakshit Sambandh? Many less. Asurakshit Sambandh is the term used in a lot of HIV information to mean unsafe sex. Now, for most of the community, that is not a term that we would use to say unsafe sex. There's a lot of colloquial terms, but this is what the written material says. So just an example, we have many examples.
And I just wanted to add one more thing about what you're saying in Jackson Heights going to the stores. You know, last year we had our kind of our community event, and I was trying to get sugar-free mithai, which is kind of like an oxymoron. Sugar-free mithai before, and I'm like, it's a Pakistani owner, and he was talking to me in Urdu, and I was like, I know that you have mithai that I used to have, and he's like, well, I stopped making it. I'm like, why? And he's like, because people come, and, you know, people would buy it, but they would say, I haven't lost weight, you know, and I would ask him, how much did you eat? And he was like, I finished the whole box. And I think that's what something that Mundur and Ahar will have to change a little bit. Like, however much sabzi I want to eat, I can eat them. If it's cooked in like tons of oil, maybe not.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, a lot of the providers themselves may not have this information. I think that's part of it, is getting appropriate, culturally appropriate diet information.
That's something that is such a constraint for us.
Absolutely. We started a network of providers in New York City also looking at diabetes again in the South Asian community. And overall, the one question that every doctor said to us is, can you give us nutritional guidelines with the South Asian diet? And we know they exist out there. They exist back home, for sure. They also exist here. They're just not getting to the community. And so we really, I mean, community health worker model is one way, but I want to take that as a segue to also talk to Rajwinder a little bit about how we work with providers and medical students and others, you know, medical professionals, people in the field, in terms of addressing the community and how are they connecting to the community as well. So I wanted to ask you about that.
Can you talk a little about the time?
Of course, yeah.
Time model, but to start following on that with the nutrition example, we do a lot of workshops on different topics, and there's been tons of interest in doing nutrition, so we're working on South Asian nutrition, on South Asian foods, so hopefully we'll have that. The giant model is a behavior change model. It's follows the stages of change model from public health. It's a, I know we use this term a lot, but it's a holistic approach to health, not just physical health and emotional health, mental health, occupational health, everything that's health related, which is just what I'm saying. And a lot of our work is sort of community outreach and education. That's the key to anything. We sort of, it's taken so long to where we are now, because a lot of the time, about 4 years, it's just a lot of conversation with the community, where are they, what are their needs to get to developing a program. And we developed the CHI program, 2 years to sort of create a program that was comprehensive. And health is a very safe topic to talk to our community about. A lot of them will want to talk about health, especially if there's, we tell them about different public benefits they can get into, they'll want to know. And then it's, well, once we've been working with them for a while, there's this trust that they come, and then they'll start talking about other things that's affecting them, like domestic violence that's going on, the work we've been used, or different, and then we'll sort of this, okay, well, this is also going on in our community, so it's just sort of really helping that way. And then there's, we recently started a walking club for the seniors that are very isolated at home. There's not space for them to go. So now they, every Wednesday and Friday, they come to the senior center, which isn't really catered to them. So we go with them in the park area. We walk and then for about an hour. And then the second half is a social activity, which is, they love the social activity. That they want to do this every day, but we know we're living on capacity. We're, it started off, we haven't done any advertising for it all. It started off with 10 individuals, and in the span of about a month and a half, it's grown to 25, and we still haven't done any advertising because we kind of feel like we grow really big really fast, but that's what we sort of want. And then we're working there, and then the senior center has, for the other communities that come, so we're trying to work on a senior, at the senior center. So we sort of, so hopefully we'll get that in the works for the next couple of months. They'll be able to come, walk, have a social activity, and have healthy South Asian nutrition food that's at the senior center, all the same thing. And we also do a health fair, so there's a lot of our community that sort of after some time they do want to go in for screening, they do want to do this, but then transportation, language, all these different things get in the way, so a lot of them have two jobs, so they don't have any time at all to go. So we started at our office and sort of converted it and put a new basement to a health fair. We invite physicians and the community members. The health fair starts at 8 o'clock. We've had three so far, and every time the community's been there an hour and a half, there's by 7 o'clock, there's at least 40, 50 community members waiting in line. And then the same thing, there's all of the times have high blood pressure, all of them are needed. And it's not very like, oh, I'm supposed to get it. It's like, no, you're not. There's stuff you can do to take care of yourself. And so a lot of the healthcare providers are sort of really surprising. Is this really their BP of 25-year-olds? Yes, they have a BP of like 40-year-olds. And how we work with healthcare providers is we have a referral system for a lot of community members that don't qualify for low-cost programs or there's language issues. And we sort of, there's a network of providers that we have. We send them to them, they'll steer community members for low-cost or for free most of the time, like for dentists, different female doctors. There's a wide range of positions. And then we also give cultural competency trainings to physicians. So from that then into our network, we give them cultural competency training on how sort of the different cultural nuances of the South Asian community. And that's just not to people in our network, but to other physicians, other healthcare, other clinics, county clinics that want to know, we sort of go out there. And then there's healthcare providers, they walk throughout the health fair, so they're now coming on a quarterly basis to help. And we're working on getting a health advisory board so that there's for us a place to go talk to them. And they donate a lot of their resources by volunteering their time and then getting a lot of free services for the community at the health fair.
Excellent. The network of providers, I think, is amazing.
And that's great. I'm wondering
how did you recruit them? How did you get those guys?
I think it's sort of word of mouth. Someone knows there's so many MDs and South Asians, so someone knows someone, will talk to them, and then they'll refer to somebody else, and then everyone that works for this, or even community members will know a doctor, and they'll tell them about some of the stuff that we do, and then the doctor will contact us, and then we'll go and work with them. So it's sort of word of mouth that we position.
That's excellent. Yeah, we've done similar work with diabetes care in New York, and I think we just literally walked around the space and we saw signs. Okay, doctor this, doctor that, look like South Asian names, let's go in. But I was curious to hear all the things that we've talked about also right now a little bit, the community health worker model, the healthcare model, even trying to create this network of providers. Frankly, a little bit of it is kind of trying to create solutions because the system is not addressing all the needs properly. And so we have to kind of go outside of that. And we're doing all of these things that are sort of like above and beyond what existing health services already give us. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't do that. But I think that, for example, I know that a lot of the community depends on these health fairs. And the health fair becomes their regular medical home. And unfortunately, what happens is that, I'm not saying we shouldn't keep doing health fairs, because we do need to keep doing health fairs, but I think the sort of funny thing that we need to balance is how do we make sure that we are not just using kind of this, only this approach, like kind of almost like it turns out to be a band-aid on a huge wound in terms of addressing the issue and having repeated health fairs, and then those people never really actually getting a regular source of care. So I want to go back to you, Deanna, because to me, I mean, I think the way of addressing the system and changing the system, of course, is through policy work and through some of our advocacy. I was going to ask you, what specific pieces of policy that are out there right now, and especially with the new administration, of course, Obama has said that healthcare reform, the first 100 days, you know, he's very committed to this. What sorts of policy pieces are out there that we can, as a community, get in place to address the health disparities in the South Asian community? What sorts of things what sorts of bills do we need passed? What sort of acts do we need to enforce? I just wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
Okay. Yeah, we have a number of priority issues that will address the three A's that Satna talked about: accessibility, affordability, and advocacy. First, unfortunately, a lot of the debates have focused around coverage, but coverage is really linked to having that usual source of care. So in terms of coverage issues, expanded coverage means ensuring that all persons have access to that coverage regardless of their immigration status. So ensuring immigrant inclusion in the recent Children's Health Insurance Program reauthorization, we were able to give states the option to cover recently arrived lawfully residing children, immigrant children, and women. We would like to see that become a mandate and expanded to the entire Medicaid program. We also have to be careful if there are employer mandates and or individual mandates, that there has to be affordable coverage available to all workers, whether it's a taxi cab driver or a nail salon owner or worker. They need to be able to have access to that affordable care without any immigration restrictions because, again, in terms of costs, going to the emergency room is a lot more expensive than giving someone a regular medical home. In terms of language access, we need to ensure that language services are included as a required benefit that the health plans participating in healthcare, the healthcare exchange, has to offer. And not only do we have to require that, but we need to make sure there's adequate resources. So again, in the Children's Health Insurance Program, we were able to get enhanced federal match because most federal programs require the state to contribute some money towards it. And so we need the federal government to pick up more of the cost of that because we're all coming from states with huge budget problems. So we need to ensure that federal reimbursement is included in all the public programs, Medicaid, Medicare, and the CHIP program. In terms of quality of care, we're really working on improving data and research on Asian American state of mind specific markers, especially this aggregated data and within your own community, as people have talked about, the difference between the Bangladeshi community and the Indian community. There's very huge differences in terms of access to care and health status. We also are working on providing more resources for community health workers and ensuring a diverse workforce. So that was a great story you told about the cultural competency materials that people are using. We all know that the best care comes from someone from your own culture who's been studied to show greater satisfaction, better care when you're being served by someone who looks like you. And to also emphasize Kritika's point, it's not just your doctor. You haven't spent any time with your doctor. We need a culturally diverse workforce that includes nurses, nurse practitioners, community health workers, patient navigators, which will really improve the quality of care.
That's great. Did you have any policy pieces you wanted to add on to that as well? Some more recommendations?
Just that the whole access to insurance, why it's needed. I mean, there have been some statistics that show, especially in New York City, that I know Saks did a survey of insurance, and it was something like 66% of South Asians in New York City don't have insurance. And a survey done of taxi workers shows that 80% of taxi workers don't have insurance. And just on a personal level, last year there were two health fairs that the Taxi Workers Alliance did, and that they participated in. And I think one of them was in JFK Airport, where this Pakistani cab driver, he didn't have any insurance, had been living here for 10 years. He has five kids. His wife was in Pakistan, and there isn't. There was one of those insurance people there. I introduced him. I think it was Medicare, Medicaid, or whatever. But even these insurances that are supposed to be for the poor people or whatever, they are not. They were like, oh, you are a above the line, you know, and but he has like 5 kids, and you know, the amount he was earning is not enough for that, you know, but yet he's not eligible for insurance. So the thing from that perspective, of the human perspective, I think is really important. And also, one of the focus group participants that we had, there was a woman who just recently came from Bangladesh, and she doesn't have insurance, and she's diabetic. She was like, oh yeah, I'm taking the medicine that I bought from me from Bangladesh, you know, and I'll keep on taking it till I guess I run out, and then I'm not sure what I'll do, you know. So these are the practical examples. I'm showing you why it's important to have insurance.
And just to expand on a little bit more in terms of the policy recommendations, a lot of what you spoke to was great in terms of the health recommendations. Krithika mentioned also some of the, you know, immigration issues and labor issues, and so when you first were talking, you know, there are labor laws that we have on the books, for example, the Fair Labor Standards Act or OSHA or all these things. They don't cover a lot of the industries that our community members work in, you know, so taxi drivers, nail salon workers, garment workers, you know, they can be forced to work for as long as the employer wants them to work. They can be given as little pay as the employer decides to give them, and all that, because we don't have the laws that are reaching out to also all these communities. And so that's another policy piece. I just want to tell all of you as well, I think we all have a role to play in advocating. And as you're reading through the news that's coming out about healthcare reform in this country, look for these key things. Look for the key things that Deanna mentioned as well. Look for reauthorization. Look for these issues. I mean, part of the problem, I think, in terms of, you talked about the diversity between Bangladesh and Indian communities, and of course, aside from language issues between the various communities, I would argue that on a whole, the South Asian community has very similar behavioral practices, you know, and all of those things. So dividing our community in terms of behavior and all is not the way to go. I would say look at things like income, class, immigration status. Those are the places where you can see the disparities. So the reason why what we might see more disparity is because we have 75% of the South Asian community that are foreign-born. If they're foreign-born, one easy way of looking at that is because you're foreign-born, that also means that of those 75%, some have the right to vote, but many of them don't have the right to vote. The majority of that 74% do not have the right to vote because they're not naturalized. And if that is the case, then that means that that's why government officials may not also respond to the needs of those community members. And not to be cynical, but unfortunately they are looking for a vote at the end of the day, and they want to respond to the constituents that will vote them in again. So, you know, if our constituencies cannot vote, then that's also one of the reasons our voices are not being heard. So we have to figure out other ways of getting those voices heard. We have a little time left. I want to actually open it up, do something a little non-traditional, and kind of open it up right now in the sort of halfway, middle, three-fourths point, just some questions and some discussion, and we'll come back and wrap up with the panelists as well. So,
thank you very much. I have many examples for undocumented. Now, this week, one is going to die. Stage, and one is also second, and the one is two kidney damage, and the hospital told they are not going to treat because she is undocumented and she's going to back to Nepal, and the one is just now I have a message here yesterday night, and my name is Narvada, I'm working with Adhikar, and the 1 hour member left message. She is working as a nanny, and most of the nannies say they don't have to check up for their health. So we took 2 times appointment, but her employer not allowed to go to for checkup. Now she is serious, and I told her just now, okay, you leave the job, and I will take care 1 month, then you check up your health, then after you look your job.
Right.
So this is the very, now economic crisis is very hit for the domestic worker.
Yeah.
They have, if they leave the job, very hard to find the another job. Then which is the option? Job or health?
Right, absolutely. That's a very unfair choice to make, and I think that's kind of part of the point, is that, you know, do you, like you said, leave your job or do your job or go to health? And I think a lot of times when healthcare providers respond to the needs of the community, they'll say, well, why didn't they come for their checkup? Why didn't they just come for their follow-up? Why? Well, you know, taking off of work is a luxury that some of us have, paid vacation. And obviously, if you're working in something like childcare, you can't take a day off of work very easily. So that's probably also why people are not getting childcare.
The low wage and the domestic work, they have very difficult to survive their life.
Thank you for sharing that. Do you have any responses, any of you?
Yeah. And I have one question.
Yeah.
One of our member, she has two kidney problems, but hospital told us they are not going to treatment for her. Any option?
Either you want to take that?
I'm not sure if it's possible, but some hospitals have a charity program, or if you can advocate for them, like they're going or have existing physicians or other community members with them, kind of the power numbers, and then you can talk to the county or to the hospital and see if there's something they can do. Sometimes they have charity programs where they'll cut off half payments or something like that.
Yeah, and one is. One second, please.
Yeah, sure.
One is liver cancer, and she's dying stage, and she was asking me help.
Mm-hmm.
Then is there any help for her? Now she's in hospice.
Right. And how she's on documented status?
I think so.
I'm just, the reason I asked that is simply with regards to what she's eligible for.
Yeah.
Does she have children? Or she just
yes,
children?
She has children, but
small.
Not small.
Well, there's. Go ahead. You want
to? No, it's just thinking maybe. I mean, we can talk after the panel and see what's available. It's in New York, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Of us are working in the city and try to come up with solutions.
Absolutely.
Particular cases.
But I like that, Rajendra, you mentioned the charity option because I think New York City is really another universe. And with regards to access to healthcare, especially, I see a lot of people from other parts of the country. The public health system in New York is quite liberal and quite progressive and does respond to the needs of undocumented as well. So we definitely have very good options in New York. We can talk about that. In other parts of the country, though, if you don't have that option, contact the hospital and look for charity options, look for charity care, or even go to South Asian providers and individual private providers and ask them to take on a case. You know, that might be also another option for going about it. I know it's a piecemeal approach, but that might be one way of doing it too.
I just wanted to comment on what you had said about, the nanny who cannot access services, and that's something really important because you may have all the service, like doctors generally, they don't understand the community's needs. They'll tell you like, oh, you have cancer, okay, this is what you need to do, goodbye, you know. And the emotional aspects are the fact that this person took out 5 hours in their day to come to see this doctor and is, you know, getting paid $8 an hour, all of that, the doctor doesn't care about. I'm not letting in the community health worker model, but just to give an example about why that's important is that, you know, even in doing the focus groups, you need to think about what time of the days are women going to be free. They have children, so, should we have this right after they drop their kids off to school? For the men, we found out we actually did a focus group. One of them was kind of like weird. We did it on Friday, which we realized was a messed up day to do because of the Jummah prayers. But these were men who all said every day in the afternoon is good for us. And we were like, what about work? And these are people who didn't have work right now. Again, an example of the economic crisis and what it's doing, you know. But I think that's why it's important to have solutions that are not just like normally you have a great program and they'll say, come from 7 to 9 p.m. on Tuesday. And people can't come at those times. You have to really think about what's accessible, not just in terms of language and all of those things, but actually what people's lives are like, you know, and that's really important to have an idea of, you know, and so that you're not just an armchair, like, oh, this is what's of concern. So even what we did in the focus group of, like, finding out what topics that people want to learn about, how do they want us to do that, instead of us thinking, they really need to know how to exercise, you know, like, we need to know what is important for people to do.
Absolutely. And I just want to go back to something you said that, you know, I know where you're coming from, but in terms of the statement, like, maybe doctors don't care, they're not responding, I think part of the problem is also the system, of course, and that's why I want to go back again to the policy piece of having incentives also for providers to be able to respond. I mean, having things like culturally appropriate nutrition guides, having things like having language services reimbursable. Part of the reason why hospitals don't offer interpreters is because they're not going to get paid back for that. If we get Medicaid, as Deanna mentioned, if we get Medicaid to pay the hospital back, or pay the health center back every time they use an interpreter or every time they use the language line, of course they want to do it. You know, I don't want to assume that a doctor wouldn't want to take that option as long as they're getting paid back for it, you know. So, and I think that's part of the issue as well, which is why the policy pieces are also so important. I see a question.
It's not a question. I want to share my experience in a very important area that we often encounter while giving service to domestic violence survivors, is that a psychological issue.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I'll just share one story of us having a lot of trouble with a client who had we put her into our traditional home. And we realized that she seriously needs, attention, going to the psychiatrist, needing medication because she was hoarding things. She was endangering others in a transitional home. And at the end, we had to let her go because she just refused to go to a psychiatrist for help. So we have this taboo, we have this myth in our days in society that if you go to a psychiatrist, you're deemed to be a bad person, which is so badly ingrained in us. And we need to reach out to the society. We need to do a lot of education seminars on health, saying, reaching out to people, especially students, youths, who will make a difference. And this year we are focusing on that. We are having a seminar on health providers, and we'll focus on that. So what I'm trying to focus your attention on is that since we are all doing, trying to do service, extending our service to the community, we should all keep this in mind that we should do a lot of educative programs where our Desi mentalities change towards this particular issue of, going to a psychiatrist, which at the end helps you rather than, handicap you.
Absolutely. And I'm glad you mentioned the word mental health. Unfortunately, it has not come up explicitly yet, but of course, that's one of those. We were talking a lot about safe issues, talking about diabetes and heart disease are actually quite safe in the terms of we don't have that same taboo and stigma. I do know that SAN out in Southern California has done the first needs assessment on the health needs of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer South Asians, a lot of which were mental health needs. And, that's a sort of a landmark study, really just the tip of the iceberg in terms of other stuff that we need to do with regards to mental health issues. I do want to talk a little bit about the stigma, though, because over the last 6 months, I will tell you, at my office in Sahin, I've gotten about 10 different individuals, separate individuals, requesting mental health services. So if people have gone to the point and broken past that stigma and the taboo and picked up the phone and said, hey, I need a mental health provider, or for myself or for my family member, that to me is alarming because that means that there's so many more and we need to train more people that are South Asians in mental health, and we also need to somehow encourage South Asian mental health providers, especially those that are bilingual, to connect to the community. I think that's where Rinder, you were talking as well about getting the network of providers. Something like that, what they're doing with SAN, is so useful in other parts of the country as well in terms of connecting providers with the community. Another question?
In relation to mental health, we do have a mental health aspect of our health. We work with a lot of this is started a couple of years ago. We came up with a member that would want services. There's a case manager and a therapist that goes to their home, and then if there's services they qualify, they get those services. And we would not want to leave. And then a lot of them are now calling other community members. A lot of them have joined the walking club, and that's really helped their emotional well-being. And they've told other community members that are just isolated, like, you need to go to SAN, and the therapist needs to come to your home and talk to you so you feel better. So it's slowly, the multiplier effect on this health is slowly happening.
I want to just, first of all, I think the work that all of you are doing is amazing. I'm trying to do it in D.C., and it's a little hard, but it's great. I also want to sort of point out that I actually use the term health inequity instead of equity because I don't think it's equal. And it's a little negative. And I also think that there's a huge need in populations and subsidized populations, but there's also a huge need in people who have power. I live with my parents, and so I see them have their kitty parties, and the food they eat, and the way they die. They have power, yet they're completely uneducated when it comes to public health models. I spend my time talking about why public health is different than medicine and why I decided to go get an MPH degree instead of an MD degree. And I think it's really important that as we do these programs, that we reach out to all audiences of our spectrum and not just necessarily focus on certain populations. Though every population is, or every sort of targeted population is very important, but it's also really important. We've had a lot of conversation here about sort of some of the populations that have limited resources. I think it's also important to get public health programs or just a socioeconomic sort of work done in medical programs at the school level, in law programs. I'm not very familiar with law programs, so I'm not sure if it's out there or not. So I think it's important to look at all ends of the spectrum.
Absolutely. Thank you. Kobita, you can
ask. Okay. Thank you. I got all the very new and amazing experiences learned from you. Thank you very much. I have one question about that. As we are going through a very crisis moment, economic and all other aspects, so is there any way to review the, from the policy perspective, the review the existing facilities available for the service delivery provision for the South Asian community? In particular, I would like to give an example, like using the phone translation for the patient. To me, from my working experience, I got that it doesn't work at all, but we are paying that much money. Instead of that, if we can provide some translator with the patient, that works much better,
yes.
And that makes life, both the providers and the patient's life, easy. So is there any provision to review the existing service facility?
And by the way, there's also other languages missing. Too.
Exactly.
Nepali is not
Nepali.
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 And what is the way?
Nobody
mentioned
Nepal
and Nepali. I'm very sad.
I just want to say something quick. I am personally a freelance interpreter in my language, but a lot of patients do not know that they are available. The only thing is they have to request it. If they don't, they will not, but they have the funds, but they don't know that. But sometimes some people, Bangladeshi, whatever language it is, they're afraid. They're like, oh, I don't need an interpreter. They think, you know, they're going to look dumb.
Sure.
That's not the point.
Sure.
The point is, even though you understand a little bit of English, but there's a lot of things you do not understand it.
Mm-hmm.
But you have the right, you can request it. There's no dumb questions, no dumb answers.
I'm glad you mentioned another very important word, which is rights. But Diana, I wanted you to respond.
Yes, that's a really good point. So I think part of it also, there's a lot of aspects of language access, but I think we do need to, we are advocating for more research to improve the quality of interpretation, for example. There are some studies that show differences between these different online, and with new technology, I think providers are jumping in, like, research everything, but they're not necessarily with us. And are you from New York?
Right.
Because I know there they use the remote simultaneous wireless telephone device, and I'm really about some funding to evaluate that. But part of our policy work is, I think, you know, we talk about doing more with less, but we also have to do better.
Why I mention this is because through my work experience, I got several examples on that. That the South Asian community, they are to the provider, and the question, the things the patient is trying to share with the service provider doesn't match with the interpreter on the telephone, right? So they are, what they are asking and what the provider is listening, absolutely different things. They are putting the prescription based on that information,
yeah,
and
right.
that doesn't help.
That's a quality issue. And
yeah.
There needs to be accountability, so we need to ensure the quality measures include, you know, is there adequate and effective communication.
I know we're done, but if I can take another 5 minutes of your time, it would be ended late. So, Ayaz, maybe you had a question? Or?
I just wanted to, of course, since everybody in this room is, a lot of us are from New York, but other parts of the country, I think one thing we can do is at least educate ourselves about laws and wherever we live. There are specific things that specific hospitals do. If we can educate ourselves, it takes a long time, but you start figuring it out. And sad thing is we see cases like that every day. I'm actually horrified to find out that even people like the one that Sapna mentioned, he spoke English, he's pretty middle class. He ended up in Kier, and then it dropped out. I mean, that's horrible. And actually in a city like New York, where they say that he should be actually in Kier. And I mean, it's the same case like you're right next to Elmhurst Hospital in Queens. And you have two people with serious problems.
Yes.
And how come you didn't know about these things? I mean, what has the hospital done?
Mm-hmm.
Is this city's failure? I mean, is it the other people in the city that they're not getting this information?
Mm-hmm.
They're doing, well, they're not doing their best, obviously. You know, sometimes these things are actually illegal. They have laws in New York City that you are supposed to give certain services.
I see the lawyers nodding, yeah.
Yeah, and sometimes people don't know, hospitals don't know, laws have changed, and they do these things that are actually illegal. So sometimes it just takes, like, maybe a lawyer to just call them and say, by the way, this is illegal. So that's as advocates, you can do that. They actually, you just call, and I use the word client. They don't know who you are. They're like, I have a client. And they're like, your client.
Yeah,
he owes you $700, but you're not supposed to. And they're like, okay, send him and we'll get the bill.
Yeah.
You know, so they're annoying.
It was actually you. A few of you commented on cultural competency trainings, and I was just curious. I've been working with different networks of providers as well, and I found that within the community, there's a need for cultural competency training of people from that same community of how to deal with other communities.
Absolutely.
If you've dealt with that, if anyone can speak about other trainings or if there's information out there on that.
I was just going to address not quite exactly that question, but I was going to say there are a couple of models that sort of use some of these aspects. So in Chicago, we actually have a group that does specifically multilingual health access training. So they train people who are able to do interpretation and translation, primarily interpretation, and it's geared toward just healthcare providers. So they train people in a variety of different languages. So and they have a good curriculum and so on. So that's one aspect. Similarly, in San Francisco, the Asian Women's Shelter had the multilingual access project, which is very similar in that it trains. It has a number of people on call who are able to speak a number of different languages, and actually they're trained in providing domestic violence services. So I think there are models out there. The question is, how do you sort of access these, and how do you replicate these, and sort of the need for replication?
Absolutely.
Because some of these are actually smarter ways of doing things, I think, without a great deal of huge cost, because people are often paid by the time that they spend on.
Yeah. At the Center for Good Health, we have a training that we do on cultural competence, and I usually find the main trainer for the training course. I usually find that it's the immigrant doctors and nurses and et cetera themselves that are actually very anti-immigrant in terms of saying. So I think part of it is like restructuring it. When I do teach cultural competence, rather than talk about these are the needs of this and this and these are the needs of that, it's about good communication. It's about listening to your patient. It's about having an open dialogue. It's about asking questions of them and making sure they can ask questions back to you. So I think part of it is when you address the information to people from that community itself, it's about reframing it, not necessarily in terms of culture as we know it, in terms of race, ethnicity, and nationality, but rather in terms of things like sexual orientation and gender, immigration status, and class, and all of these other various social determinants of health, saying again, and how they relate back to health, because they may feel they're totally adequately prepared to deal with the community that they come from. However, they may not be totally culturally competent. None of us are 100% culturally competent in dealing with someone from a different social category, whatever that category is.
And just so you know, from a policy end, we're working on including cultural competency within the policy measures. And so just to illustrate how it gets played out in policy, the National Quality Assurance, NCQA, that actually credits health plans and the Joint Commission, which accredits hospitals, they're looking at cultural competency within the context of patient-centered care. So rather than using stereotypes, as you pointed out, you know, look at where the patient is coming from and listening to all of them, whether it's their sexual orientation, their ready for the class, or education class. Just you need to take all that consideration when you're seeing.
I wanted to give you a chance to respond to, because I know you do help with Optimus Trading as well, so just curious if you had a response to that.
We usually do them for positions, not for other community members, but other communities, when they gather, we'll have them sort of tell each other about their community. So that usually happens. All of our spaces are open to all South Asians, so community members, we'll have them share some of their stories about their communities.
We are over time. I just want to see if there is, are there any more questions? We did start 10 minutes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I just want to invite everyone to the Health Forum is having our national conference on June 1st and 2nd. And that week is also the National Capacity Conference. And as you see, there's a Congressional Asian American Psychologist Town Hall. So our goal is to get a lot of Asian American psychologists to Washington, D.C., and the flood of all the Congress and New Friends done this week, but also talk with members of the administration. And then the other thing is that there's also going to be a special journal of the American Journal of Public Health, and there's a call for papers to a special journal on Asian American Saving Lives and Psychological Health. So all you public health community-based researchers and scholars, please submit something.
And just another quick plug-in for those of you in New York, or maybe this will bring you to New York on May 10th. Dream has an event where we will be unveiling the results of our focus groups, which is the first focus groups on diabetes in the Bangladeshi community, and we have a cultural program and try to have some healthy food. You'll see if we get to that.
But I'll leave some of our health materials and just send to the study that Sutton was talking about also the other people in the group. And there's an article on LA Times that also brought that talked about some of the economy impacts of the elderly, so that's also about people.
Just as kind of a wrap-up point as well, and I'm glad you ended the materials, because I wanted to say that a lot of us have, you know, good materials that I think we've been working hard to try to collect. We can share some of them, but I think others we probably didn't bring with us necessarily, but we can probably try to direct you. So if you all are looking for linguistically, culturally appropriate materials, you can try to help with some of that, because I think a lot of the times, we had a meeting yesterday with the Department of Health, we had doctors in the room that were like, we don't know where to get them because NCI doesn't provide them, or CDC doesn't provide them, or DOH, I'm like, yeah, because they don't know that we exist. So part of it is also knowing, is telling them. And they, I just want to give you a point that the Department of Health shared with us yesterday. They said all it takes is to give us a phone call. That's it. Because Office of Minority Health, the reason why they print things in certain languages is they count the number of requests they have for certain languages. In order to get things printed, we need to literally pick up the phone and flood their inboxes and their voicemail message boxes with requests for the various languages that we need. And I will share that number. I don't know if I have it with me right now, but I can give it to you if you're interested. Call the Office of Minority Health, tell them that we need materials in Nepali, in Punjabi, in Bangla, in Urdu, in Hindi, in every other language that's out there, so that we can also address all these needs. So with that, I want to say there's a lot of work that we are doing on health equity. I think I'll speak for all of us in saying that we're very excited to collaborate with any of you that are out there. If you want to come and speak to us now, we're going to hang out for another 5 minutes or so. We can exchange business cards and talk further. But there's a lot more that we need to do that we depend on, not only all of you, but all the community that you all represent as well, to do that work for. So, with that, we need to kind of work together to empower and build a more equitable sort of health for the South Asian community. Thank you for coming today. I'm sorry.